The Ozarks at Large podcast is made possible by KUAF's contributing listeners. Support from individual listeners in our community helps pay for the cost of producing and distributing this podcast. If you'd like to support this podcast and other digital media produced by KUAF, you can make a contribution at supportkuaf.com.
This is 91.3 KUAF, your public radio station for more than 32 years, and this is Ozarks at Large for Monday, May 15th, 2017. I'm Kyle Kellums. In about 6 minutes, Michael Tilley from Talk Business and Politics explains what the pro hack in Fort Smith was and why nonprofit and charitable organizations here and possibly across the country should take note. And later, Becca Martin Brown from the Northwest Arkansas Democrat Gazette explains why relaxed shows at Walton Arts Center can introduce live arts to new families. First, after voters in the Pea Ridge School District failed to pass a millage increase last week, the district is looking ahead to how it's going to deal with growth that it had planned to ease with the money that would have come from the increased millage. Ozarks at Large's Zuzanna Sitek spoke with the superintendent of Pea Ridge Schools about what comes next.
Pea Ridge Schools Superintendent Rick Neal says the district has spent the last 2 years planning for student growth and how they're going to tackle it. In this year, he says it was time to ask residents for a millage increase.
Over the last 6 months to a year, probably, we came up with a plan, as long as with the partnership program, the facilities money that we could receive from the state, that we would build a high school and be able to spread out our existing campuses. So that was the best solution for our growth issue.
Neal says from the 2015-2016 school year to the 2016-2017 school year, the district went from having 1,956 students to 2,062. That's more than 100 more students from one school year to the next. And the district projects 6-7% growth year over year in the future. Last week, the district asked residents for 5.1 additional mills, which would have provided about $8.6 million for a new high school. The state would have also contributed $10.6 million had the millage passed. But on Tuesday, the proposal failed 494 votes to 421. Neal says he's disappointed, but also says the district could have better communicated with the community about its plan.
We had several issues that we felt like that weren't answered for our community, and I think that had something to do with it. Also, we had, you have a demographic of population that doesn't have children in our school, and they came out and voted, and so their vote was loud and understandable. I think the big piece will be is getting some of our younger voters and trying to get the demographic that that we've really got to come together to educate the students at Pea Ridge, and it's about all of us, not just one demographic.
Neal says the district will improve its message next time they ask for a millage increase. He also wants people to know the district's millage increase request was higher than Rogers and Bentonville because property assessment values are not as high in Pea Ridge as they are in the other two cities.
Released as the highest millage in the state. Well, there's some reasons why that is. We have $94 million worth of assessed valuation, so it's not significant enough to do the things that we need to continue to do.
According to the state's formula, the $94 million worth of assessed property value in Pea Ridge amounts to a little over $4 million for the school district.
We have 53 square miles in our community. It doesn't generate the, our state schools or schools in our state are basically funded by foundation funding, and the assessed valuation is a big piece of that, and our small area doesn't generate the millage rate or the millage amount as Rogers and Bentonville, Gravette, and those people. So yes, it does cost us more because of that piece of it, because we just don't have the assessed valuation.
Neal says whenever the millage does pass, it will take an additional 2 years to construct the new high school. So for now, he says, they'll have to deal with the growth and any overcrowding in other ways, like modular buildings that will serve as classrooms. Despite the setback, Neal says he knows his students still have the community's full support.
They love their Blackhawks, and they love our school, and I think that we'll just be able to work a little bit more congruent together over the next year, coming up with the next plan.
Neal says they will likely come back to voters with a new millage proposal next year. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Zuzanna Sitek.
A millage increase of 5.1 would have translated to about $102 more in taxes per year per every $100,000 worth of property value for city residents. This is Ozarks at Large.
The day's news can seem like a barrage of information. NPR hits the pause button. We ask one more question, get a different perspective, and explain how it affects your life. Stand with the facts. Listen every day.
It is Monday, May 15th, 2017. This is Ozarks at Large. With me on the phone from his office in Fort Smith is Michael Tilley with Talk Business and Politics. Michael, happy George Brett's birthday.
All right. You would know that. Of course you would know that.
He hit 390 in 1980, by the way.
Yeah, and he almost hit a referee. What was the year he hit the umpire?
That would have been, I think, 85 or 86. I think it was 86. It was the year after the first Royals World Series when the home run was taken away. And then, let's point out, was then reinstated by the Commissioner of Baseball.
Right. Yeah. He came out of that dugout like he'd been ejected.
Oh, my gosh.
Great.
Yeah. Yes. Well, I didn't get you on the line to talk about George Brett exclusively. Let's help me out with something that happened last week in Fort Smith. ProHack. This involves computers and passwords and software, and I'm already in over my head.
Well, and I'm going to get in over my head just shortly after you. Okay. So, but look, this is the big picture view is Steve Clark, not Steve Clark, the chamber person in Fayetteville, but Steve Clark, the founder and CEO of ProPack, conducted in. Before I get into that, Steve Clark has been an extraordinary supporter in the last two or three years. He's really come on. He's the guy behind the Murals Festival, mm-hmm. The Unexpected Project. There's a mural there in Fayetteville as part of that. It really, he's taken a lot of ownership, a lot of personal pride in making sure Fort Smith, especially downtown Fort Smith, is modernized, reinvigorated. He is focused on making what he says, making Fort Smith a cool place to live so that those millennials and that future talent that a future workforce needs will find it a good place to live. So this ProHack is just an extension of what he's doing, where he's bringing some of the developers, the software developers in his own company. And he essentially gave them 48 hours to come up with some ideas. One of those ideas was, I think, which is very interesting, is to connect resources and people with charities in the area. So, for example, and don't ask me how it works, but part of it is, the software will say, well, this charity needs this type of food or this type of help to help these homeless people or these people that are hungry or for this food bank and that type of thing. And it can connect them in real time and remove some of those barriers where people will say, well, if I just knew how to help, I would. Well, here you go. We're using technology apps to connect those resources to charities in need in real time. And I think that's amazing. And again, these guys have just, guys and girls have just, took 48 hours to build this from the ground up. They're going to see what works. I guarantee you there will be some there'll be some stuff that'll fall by the wayside that doesn't work. But there'll be some permanency with some of these things that I wouldn't be surprised if it not only takes off in Fort Smith, but it becomes something that other communities around the country will say, hey, come show us how to do that.
Well, and that's kind of the idea between of these events, right? You get these people together, you got all these creative, imaginative, brilliant minds together, and they start bouncing ideas off each other, and in a relatively short amount of time, something can be built.
Right, and what they do is then they bring their ideas, their expertise to the community and say, okay, here, we've done this, how can you help us make it better? And this is the inaugural, which means it's not going to be the last. So it'll be, I've talked to some people involved. They're already looking forward to the next one.
All right. Now, we go from something that's very new school to something that's a little bit more old school, roads. Last week, the ribbon cutting for the Bella Vista bypass. This is something that has been, those four syllables have been mentioned by a lot of mouths for a lot of time. It's not done yet by any stretch. And it's just a stretch of what we hope is eventually an I-49 that connects several states. But it was refreshing for a lot of people to see this happen last week.
Well, it was. I mean, we've had some critics who say, well, it's still just kind of a road to nowhere. Well, yeah, I mean, you're going to have that until it gets completed, but it's better than not being there. It's, you know, the money was available to build it. And it's just, you know, these, unfortunately, you know, the federal government, state government, both in Arkansas and Missouri, you know, don't have the $3, $4, $5 billion that's needed just to make this thing happen all at once. So these segments are very important. I know there are some people who now say that the stretch from Alma to where the interstate begins in East Fort Smith or Chaffee Crossing is next, but that requires that bridge across the Arkansas River, which, you know, ranges between $300 and $600 million, depending on who you talk to. So, and I've heard that part being talked about since 1994. So y'all forgive me if I'm a little skeptical, but that is the next big segment that's really needed to keep the project going. Of course, Missouri has been further ahead than Arkansas on the project. For those that have driven to Kansas City, they know, you know, that it's better once you get on the Missouri side. Obviously, from South Fort Smith around the Greenwood area down to Texarkana, that is the huge chunk that will be necessary. And that will be an expensive chunk because you're going to be pushing concrete and steel through pretty rough mm-hmm. terrain. But this back to Bella Vista, it is very important. Very good that that's finished, that the money was available. And, it, you know, ideally it'll put pressure on government officials, both federal and state, to say, look, you know, we've got this. We've got to keep this going, or we've just wasted $53 million on a bypass that
right.
really doesn't connect anything. So hopefully the politics will play toward that, and hopefully it'll play out a lot quicker than for those of us who've been waiting 20 or so years, hopefully it'll start playing out a lot quicker.
Well, there's a World Series trophy in Wrigley Field right now, so.
We got to wait 100 years for this, do we?
Well, I did. Well, yeah, that's about okay, right. That wasn't maybe the best example, but yeah. You get the idea. Eventually.
Okay.
All right.
Eventually. All right.
Thank you, Michael. Michael Tilley's with Talk Business and Politics. You can find out much more about Arkansas's business, politics, and other news by going to talkbusiness.net. Michael, have a great week.
All right. You as well. Thank you, sir.
Ahead on today's show, Charlie Allison had a tough task: collect Fayetteville's history as best he could in just 135 pages.
And certainly the 19th century, we had a brief period of Reconstruction where we had a variety of people, African-American, who had been enslaved, who were now starting businesses or doing work that previously they had not been able to do. But Reconstruction didn't last very long in Arkansas.
Charles Y. Allison explains how he accumulated and edited what's included in the new book, A Brief History of Fayetteville, Arkansas. That's ahead on today's edition of Ozarks at Large.
If you go to the grocery store and you just want some barbecue sauce, good luck choosing one.
Caribbean jerk, sesame ginger, Hawaiian, steak and chop.
The glory and curse of the limitless variety at the supermarket.
It's the best of America and the worst of America, right here in one bright neon-lit landscape.
I'm Ari Shapiro. That story this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today from 3 to 6 on 91.3. 91.3 is supported by Butterfield Trail Village, a premier Northwest Arkansas retirement community catering to active lifestyles and resident well-being, offering a variety of activities and living options from apartments to village homes, plus outdoor spaces, including access to city trails. ButterfieldTrailVillage.org for more information. The comedy The Ding Dong, a new adaptation of Fedot's classic farce, is on stage this week at Theater Squared and through June 4th, when a mostly faithful Parisian couple is tempted by suitors and femme fatales, they soon learn how opening the wrong door in the dark of night can lead to mayhem, laughter, and unlikely surprises. 443-5600 or theater2.org for tickets. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. The work to identify and quantify damage from spring floods continues. Springdale City officials estimate more than $3.5 million of damage to infrastructure because of the heavy rains and flash floods in late April. The city lists the most significant problems at Pump Station Bridge, the Lake Springdale Trailhead, and the Mountain Bike Trail. In all, the weather is blamed for $3.75 million of damage in Springdale, and the city is preparing documentation for FEMA. Concerns continue for flooding on the other side of the state. The latest rounds of heavy rain are prompting flood warnings to again be in effect for several counties along the White River in eastern Arkansas. Melody Daniel, a spokeswoman with the Arkansas Department of Emergency Management, says the department will continue creating damage estimates through the week.
Right now, we've got a tentative schedule of many counties that goes out to May 19th. All of the affected counties are not currently on this schedule, so we do anticipate that it's going to be at least another week and definitely into the week following that. The most important thing with these damage assessments is that we make sure we do things correctly the first time. That is the best way to have an efficient recovery process.
Governor Hutchinson says the damage amount will likely total in the hundreds of millions of dollars. He declared a state of emergency on May 1st. Agriculture Secretary Sonny Perdue toured the damaged areas with the governor from the air a week ago, and a team from FEMA started its assessment of the damage on Wednesday. A new 30,000-square-foot building to help train physicians in Fort Smith will be officially dedicated tomorrow. The UAMS West Regional Campus on South E Street will include 48 exam rooms, lab and x-ray facilities, and have space for ultrasound and immunization services. The formal ribbon cutting is scheduled for tomorrow at 11 a.m. A one-day gathering of professionals in various tech industries will take place later this week in Fayetteville. The 2017 Tech Fest is a technology conference designed to allow people in tech industries to learn from each other while promoting gender diversity in STEM fields. Kevin Clark, the CEO of Now Diagnostics in Springdale, will be the keynote speaker Thursday at the Fayetteville Town Center. The dean of the University of Arkansas School of Law will serve a two-year term on the Law School Admissions Council Board of Trustees. Stacy Leeds' term on the 14-person board will run from June through June 2019. The council is a national nonprofit corporation that provides products and services to assist law schools and applicants in the admission process. And the Walmart app will host a venerable rock and roll act this fall. The long touring band Kiss, members of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, scheduled to be at the Amp in Rogers September 28th. Tickets will go on sale Friday morning through the traditional Walton Art Center ticketing portals. Charles Allison has been studying, considering, and thinking about the history of Fayetteville for some time. He wasn't born in the city, but he spent most of his life there and is a graduate of Fayetteville High School and the University of Arkansas. He had been toying with the idea of a large tome dedicated to Fayetteville's history to be timed with the city's bicentennial in a few years. But an earlier opportunity developed when the History Press decided to pursue a writer to put together a smaller history called, appropriately, A Brief History of Fayetteville, Arkansas. Over 135 pages, he covers the time from before Fayetteville existed to a bumper sticker demanding residents keep Fayetteville funky, and covers as much as he can in between. Recently, Charles, that's the name on the front of the book, but his friends call him Charlie, came to the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio to talk about A Brief History of Fayetteville, Arkansas.
back when I started thinking about writing a book about Fayetteville's history, it was more than a decade ago. I just finished graduate school and had some free time on my hands, hadn't found a job yet. And I went and talked to John Lewis, who was the president of Bank of Fayetteville at that time. And he was a great supporter of the city and of history in particular. And so I just, you know, bounced some ideas off of him about a history book. And, of course, he was very receptive. But before I got started on anything, I ended up with a job. And that sort of threw a monkey wrench in everything. But I started collecting history trivia, history stories. And I had thought that I might aim for doing a book by the city's bicentennial in 2028. The last narrative history was written in 1928 on the city's centennial of its founding. And I thought it would make sense to aim a book for the bicentennial. And then the people at the History Press contacted me and said they were looking for somebody to write a brief history. And I thought, well, if I don't do it, somebody else will. And so I jumped in.
I noticed that, and it's peppered with pictures, images. A lot of them say from the author's collection. You've been collecting for a while.
Yeah, most of them are postcards, but there's some other photos that have floated out there on the internet and are in the public domain. And so I've snagged them when I could. They're nothing compared to the collections that the Shiloh Museum or the special collections at the university have. But where I knew I had an image that would work, I went ahead and used that.
What strikes me as interesting is you can thumb through this book and say, oh, my gosh, Fayetteville's changed so much. Or you can thumb through this book and go, you know what? It hasn't changed that much. You see things that are 100-plus years old, and you can figure out where they are.
Right. I think that's part of Fayetteville's success. Several years ago, I visited Oxford, Mississippi, home to the University of Mississippi, and I really felt like I had stepped back into a town that had not changed since the 1860s. The square they have looks like an antebellum square. And to some degree, there was this almost oppressive atmosphere of feeling like you were in some other century. And Fayetteville doesn't have that. It has grown. It has changed. It has retained some of its beautiful buildings. A lot of them have not, you know, been retained. But in some measure, that has, you know, meant that we progressed, we moved forward, and we don't have that. I don't feel that kind of atmosphere here, that it's stuck in the past or anything.
It's interesting because, of course, obviously Fayetteville has stayed in one place, but history sometimes comes to it. I think of the Trail of Tears and the Civil War, and you document both of those here.
Yes. Fayetteville was, you know, when the Trail of Tears occurred, and it wasn't called the Trail of Tears at that time.
Right.
It was the U.S. called it the Indian Removal. It was many decades later before somebody coined the phrase Trail of Tears. But the Indian nations in the southeast United States, the Cherokees, the Choctaws, Chickasaws, Creek, Seminole, they were all forced out of their homelands by the United States government. They were given land in exchange in what is now Oklahoma and was that at that time called the Indian Territory. The Cherokees came mostly across northern Arkansas and southern Missouri to get to Oklahoma. And at least three of the parties that came west among the Cherokees came through Fayetteville. One came right through the south side of Fayetteville. The other two came through the Mount Comfort area that at that time wasn't Fayetteville but is now. And then the Civil War, we ended up being sort of at the center of the Trans-Mississippi part of the war, especially in the early part of the war. And Fayetteville did not do well during that period. Most of the major buildings in town were burned to the ground at one time or another. So we felt the effect most erratically, I think, in Arkansas.
The last part is called Modern Fayetteville, and that is post-World War II.
Yes. I sort of tried to break up the book by what it seemed to be like recognizable periods. Ellen Compton, who I collaborated with on the earlier pictorial history of Fayetteville, she described Fayetteville sort of changing from a big town in the 1960s to a small city mm-hmm. by the end of that decade. And I think she was right. Fayetteville was small enough that everybody knew everybody. We're still not terribly big, so that lots of people know lots of people in Fayetteville. But we started really progressing into being a city where city government really took an active part in making the city develop in ways that the people wanted. And I think they've done a good job over the years.
You have a picture of the Deluxe.
Yeah, the interior.
Thank you
of the
for
Deluxe.
That. Deluxe was this great restaurant on Dixon Street years ago that had great cheeseburgers.
Yeah, and pool tables up in the arcade room. And it was one of those places that anybody from the 50s, 60s, 70s into the 80s would hang out at some point. It was just a great place to be.
You spent decades as a writer and a journalist. What did you think was your role in this history of Fayetteville? Because there are times over the last 175 years that, you know, when you think about race or things like that, that parts of history that don't reflect so well.
Yeah. Fayetteville had its issues.
And certainly, I should say, not like other parts of the South.
Yeah. Yeah. Not unlike the rest of the South. We had issues with race. We were segregated through most of the first half of the 20th century, and that lagged into the latter part of the 20th century. And certainly the 19th century, we had a brief period of Reconstruction where we had a variety of people, African-American, who had been enslaved, who were now starting businesses or doing work that previously they had not been able to do. But Reconstruction didn't last very long in Arkansas. And so between the Jim Crow laws and outright segregation, there were a lot of issues that Fayetteville had to deal with. They were fairly proactive in dealing with the legal aspects of racism. As soon as Brown v. Board was passed, the school board in Fayetteville said, yeah, we'll integrate next year. It wasn't hard for Fayetteville because the African-American population was so small. We had just two juniors the first year that the high school was integrated, so it's not terribly hard to integrate two kids into a bigger – it's hard for them.
Yeah.
It's not hard for the school district, but and that lingered for quite a while. By the 1960s, finally the last elementary schools were integrated, so you can – you know, see that took some time. And so a lot of those kind of issues Fayetteville's had to deal with, and with some success, some failures, but I tried not to gloss over any of that period or any of the other issues that Fayetteville's faced. It is a brief history, so a lot of it is glossed over just by necessity.
Yeah, before you get to the index, the text is 135 pages. And like I said, liberally, liberal use of photographs. Oh, the old swimming pool at Wilson Park. I love the photo of Sherman Morgan in his Navy uniform.
Yeah, yeah.
Sherman, of course, we had Sherman's for decades.
Sherman's pool hall and
barbecue
down on Rock Street. It's where the Yvonne Richardson, or right across the creek from where the Yvonne Richardson Center is now. And I had never seen him as a young man, and it was fun to find that and be able to use it. And
there's a picture of Leroy Pond.
Yeah.
There's a street named after here in Fayetteville, and he was a very decorated soldier.
During World War II.
Yeah.
And so finding some of that... that history, I didn't really know the 20th century history very well when
really?
I went into this. It's a lot of writers have written about 19th century Fayetteville, about the Civil War, about the founding of Fayetteville, those early periods. But as you get into the 20th century, there's just not as much writing about those periods. And it's funny, even I moved here in 1965 as I was going into second grade, and I thought, well, the period from then to now will be my easiest, and it wasn't. It was more difficult for me to step back and not think of things that, from my own viewpoint and really go back and look at sources and try to put it back together.
You end this book with another citywide topic of conversation, a protest that took place in the early 2000s when a woman tree sat to try ultimately was a failed attempt to keep trees from being cut down. And now that's just a huge shopping area.
Right. Back in the late 1990s, early 2000, I can't remember which year it was. A development came in for the north side of town, a shopping development. They wanted to cut down every single tree. I shouldn't say every single tree, but nearly every single tree.
Many trees.
a beautiful grove of oak trees, really old oak trees. And they had read our city ordinance about tree preservation incorrectly, or they'd been given bad advice maybe, and thought they could do that. And immediately the city tree preservation person said, this is not going to work. You need to preserve 17% of the canopy of this lot if you're able. And it was pretty clear looking at how big the lot was that, you could move the buildings around, change your parking some, and you could do it. It may not be most advantageous to sell your building, advertise where you are, but it could be rearranged. So the Planning Commission turned it down. The developers appealed that to the city council. The city council eventually went with the developers and felt like they had made a reasonable effort. They did save some of the trees. They did change some. But then the next morning, this 53-year-old grandmother climbed into a tree and sat up there for the next 2 weeks to protest this thing and was hoping to prevent the stores from ever building. And, it involved people going trespassing to take her food and medicine, and then kids going there trespassing, all of them being arrested because they were trespassing. It was a civic kind of duty they felt like. And eventually, this whole thing ended up in four courts. the trespassers were in municipal court. Somebody had sued the city for violation of its own ordinance, and that was in Chancery Court. And somebody else had sued over the Migratory Bird Act, and that was in federal court. So it was a crazy time.
And it's kind of I think it's interesting that you end the book there, because it does kind of sum up what's happened to Fayetteville over time, is this love of the land the town is on, but with this constant from the establishment of the University of Arkansas on through this sort of boom time we're in now, this constant struggle of keeping it the same, but moving ahead.
Yeah, it's a difficult thing. It's funny, even though everybody was really incited by the thought of these trees being cut down, this beautiful grove in what had been a huge large pasture, I mean, acres and acres of pasture. And even though everybody was excited to try to save the trees, there really wasn't anybody trying to save the pasture.
That didn't matter.
Yeah. So we both want to save things and are willing to let other things go as we go along. And I think people don't recognize that when it's happening, but I think it is one of the things that has helped Fayetteville just continue to grow. I don't know if we'll survive being, the fifth best place to live, being on those kind of charts over and over and over again. But it's drawing a lot of people here. But so far we've had the, resilience and foresight and fortitude to sort of overcome those things, even if they were momentary problems.
Well, I look forward to your recollections of this era in the 2028 published not-so-brief history
not so
of
brief
Fayetteville.
History, yeah.
One last question. If you had 140 pages instead of 135, what got left out that you just – what was the last thing to get scrubbed from the brief history of Fayetteville, Arkansas?
I probably would have put in just a little bit more about Dixon Street. As you probably know, Tony Wappel did a wonderful book about Dixon Street a few years ago. So I found myself sort of shrinking back from that, feeling like that had already been done. And I really didn't put too much. But Dixon Street is such a wonderful cross-section of Fayetteville. It starts up in the residential area on the east end, comes through the county courthouse and other civic sort of kind of buildings. And then you've got the churches and then the commercial area. It used to have industry down at the bottom of the hill, Shipley Bakery, other.
A lumber company at one point.
Lumber company, cleaners, that sort of thing. And then you rise up to the university campus. So you've got this street that just sort of embodies Fayetteville. And I wish I'd put just a little bit more in on that. So if you're a lover of Dixon Street, go find Tony's book and that'll fill in the blank that mine has.
Charlie Allison is the author of the new book, A Brief History of Fayetteville, Arkansas, recently published by the History Press. And he has been a resident of the city since 1965. There is more about the publishing company at historypress.net. And A Brief History of Fayetteville, Arkansas is also available as an ebook. This is Ozarks at Large.
Nebraska Senator Ben Sasse thinks modern American culture is making children soft.
It is good for kids to learn how to work. Right now we're acting like keeping our kids free from work is a way to treat them really nicely, when in reality, thoughtful parenting wants to help free our kids to find meaning in work.
Republican Senator Ben Sasse on his book, The Vanishing American Adult. That conversation on the next Morning Edition.
Morning Edition, tomorrow morning and every weekday morning from 5 until 9 on 91.3 KUAF. Tomorrow on Ozarks at Large, the four members of the Dover Quartet have been coming to Northwest Arkansas to participate in Artisphere for one-fourth of their lives. And their plans for the future seem like they could take up the next fourth, including a documentary film about the musicians. The process for that began this month in Fayetteville.
In fact, we're timing the launch of our Kickstarter campaign with Artisphere because we feel so comfortable here, and also that it's a really supportive community that knows us well and has known us now for years. And so we actually, when we were looking for a time to open that, we decided, oh, let's do it when we're here on home turf.
It's also nice not to be, you know, managing everything from the road and to actually be somewhere where you can kind of, you know, be at a
manage
comfortable.
Things.
Yeah.
The Dover Quartet on why they keep coming back here and what's up next on tomorrow's Ozarks at Large at noon and 7 p.m. on 91.3. The Artisphere Festival Orchestra, featuring over 90 musicians from around the world, presents its opening concert under the baton of Maestro Corrado Riveras May 17th at Walton Arts Center, performing Mendelssohn's Hebrides Overture and Brahms' Variations on a Theme by Haydn. Tickets available at 443-5600 or artispherefestival.org. 91.3 is supported by Highlands Oncology Group, helping patients fight the battle every day with a team of cancer specialists in both Benton and Washington counties. Services include radiation, CLIA certified labs, a multidisciplinary lung clinic, and a lung cancer screening program. HighlandsOncologyGroup.com.
You are listening to your public radio station, which is powered by listener support. Hi, I'm Lee Wood, KUAF's membership director. Thousands of listeners to KUAF give annual or monthly gifts to help bring you the programming you listen to every day. You can support this radio station at any time online at supportkuaf.com.
It is Monday, May 15th, 2015. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellens. With me, Becca Martin Brown, features editor at the Northwest Arkansas Democrat Gazette. What do you got for us this Monday?
Something cool. The Walton Arts Center, as part of Artisphere, is doing what they're calling relaxed performances.
Yes, very interesting.
And I'm really excited about this because I do have a daughter with disabilities, and a legal guardian for another young woman with disabilities. These productions, these performances, are intended to perhaps pull back a little bit on the things that might be hard for someone, particularly with autism.
To be aware of sensitivities and just be
light
aware.
Light and sound. Yeah. And plus, the idea being that the kids can react in any way they want to.
Mm-hmm.
They can have their fidget toys. They can make whatever sounds are appropriate to them and enjoy the performance.
I think it's a wonderful, wonderful thing.
They're doing some movie screenings that way.
Mm-hmm.
And it would be such a wonderful thing. I've always taken Amanda to plays. And so she learned at a very young age how to adapt. But I also remember taking her to movies when she was little, and she would sit on the floor between the seat and the row in front of us because the movie was too big.
Yeah, well,
too big, too much input. She was listening. She was laughing. She was reacting. But she was 20 years old before she could sit in the seat and deal with it. So this is a very cool thing they're doing. And I'm so proud of the Walton Arts Center for doing it. They did one show over the weekend. They have a remaining puppet show called The Man Who Planted Trees. And that happens at 2 o'clock on Saturday. Tickets are $10. If you have kids with disabilities and you've never been brave enough to take them to the Art Center, this is your chance. Because once they get there, and also they've created a what they call a social story that's available on the Walton Art Center website that has photos of the building and the parking lot and the volunteers in their uniforms, and you can show your kids every step of what's going to happen.
Nice.
So there's no fear factor in it. And once they learn, you pull into an art center, any of them in Northwest Arkansas, and Amanda starts to applaud. Mm. She knows something good will happen there. This is your chance to start that introduction for your kids. And I am so all about it. Hooray for the Walton Arts Center.
And it's Saturday.
It's Saturday at 2 o'clock. And then also this week, on Tuesday, an exhibit opens at the Shiloh Museum in Springdale called The Changing Face of Emma. It's a photographic look at Springdale's downtown. It's Avenue, by the way. Just need to say that. This will be on show through December 9th, and you can go check it out at the Shiloh Museum. If you've never been there, there's another good opportunity.
There's a chance.
Wednesday is Wednesday Over Water at Crystal Bridges. They're going to be talking about the outdoors at Crystal Bridges, and they're going to screen Larry Foley's The Favored Strawberry.
Oh, yes, and that is sold out.
Is it?
That, well, that's what Larry told me a couple weeks ago when he was here.
Well, never mind. Forget I said anything. But plan for the next opportunity to see his documentary, because apparently it's going gangbusters.
Yeah, and call and see if someone's canceled or something. Get on the list.
And then on Thursday, two opportunities. Mark Shanahan is in town because Theater Squared is producing his show, The Ding Dong. He's going to do a playwriting class at 4:30 at the Fayetteville Public Library. You can register at faylib.org. And then there's a lecture at 6 o'clock at the Fort Smith Regional Art Museum. It's called Slave to Citizen, and it goes with their exhibit that's photographs
of the Underground,
Railroad. The speaker is Michael Lasser, and that's $5. Reservations at 784-2787. And your third choice Thursday, because Thursday is the new Friday, is a spotlight talk by Jose Diaz, who is curator of the Andy Warhol Museum.
And where's this?
7 o'clock at Crystal Bridges.
Becca Martin-Brown is features editor at the Northwest Arkansas Democrat Gazette.
From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkansongs. Albert Green was born April 13, 1946, in Forest City, Arkansas. The table on which his mother is said to have given birth is in the St. Francis County Museum. According to his autobiography, Green was raised in nearby Lee County, Arkansas. He was from a large family. When Al Green was still a child, he and his brothers formed a gospel quartet, the Green Brothers, which toured the South. A few years later, the family moved to Grand Rapids, Michigan, and by age 16, he formed a pop group, Al Green and the Creations, with high school buddies. Two other members of the band formed a label, and the group cut Backup Train in 1967. Heard here is Backup Train. Al Green was spelled with an extra E with it on this 45, the way it was when he was born. Backup Train actually became an R&B hit, but no follow-up came. In 1969, Green met High Records VP Willie Mitchell. Musician and producer Willie Mitchell was brought to High Records in Memphis when its owner saw him perform at Danny's Club in West Memphis, Arkansas. Through much of the 20th century, petering out of the 1970s and 80s, the scene in West Memphis was fertile, with clubs like Danny's and the infamous Plantation Inn. Crittenden County's West Memphis was often frequented by Memphis musicians and others in the business. The pairing of Willie Mitchell and Al Green would bring great success to Hi Records and make R&B history. Green's first Hi single seems to be an obvious crossover attempt, the Beatles cover song Heard Here. Worrying about success or crossing over soon would be quite unnecessary. Hey, baby, you didn't go for that. Now, it's a natural fact that I want to come back. In 1970, producer Willie Mitchell released Al Green's debut solo album on Hi, Green is Blues. His first gold single, Tired of Being Alone, heard here from his second album and an Al Green composition. As the 1970s progressed, Green began writing more and developing his own style. With other songs like Call Me, Take Me to the River, Here I Am, Let's Stay Together, Love and Happiness, and Let's Get Married, Al Green's classic period was also at the apex of R&B music, and Al Green became one of R&B's biggest and most sensual stars. I can think of younger days when living for my life was everything a man could want to do. I could never see in October 1974 in Memphis, a girlfriend poured boiling grits on Al Green while he was in the bathtub and then killed herself with his gun. Green was hospitalized with second-degree burns. When he emerged, he announced his intention to join the ministry. In 1976, Green bought a Memphis church and was ordained pastor of the Full Gospel Tabernacle, but continued to tour as a soul singer and to record on Hi Records. In 1977, Hi was sold to a West Coast label. Al Green built a studio in Memphis and tried producing his own records, still conflicted in his direction. During a 1979 concert in Cincinnati, Green fell off the stage, again giving him pause and renewed religious fervor. Everything is gonna be all right. The 1980s saw Al Green focus on doing gospel albums, sometimes recording standards. In 1982, he appeared on Broadway with Patti LaBelle in the gospel musical Your Arm's Too Short to Box with God. In the 1990s, Green began to reemerge in secular music as an elder statesman. In 1994, he won a Grammy for a duet with Lyle Lovett. Like Sam Cooke and Otis Redding before him, and Prince and Michael Jackson after him, Green represents and wrestles with the dichotomy of the sacred and the profane in music. The sacred has mostly won out through the 1990s as the century turned. On most Sundays, you can go see Al Green preach at the Full Gospel Tabernacle Church in Memphis, Tennessee, just a few dozen miles from his Arkansas birthplace. Here's Al Green with his first number one hit, Let's Stay Together, released May 1971 from his third album on Hi Records in Memphis, Tennessee.
What I need. never be untrue. Oh, baby, let's stay together, loving you well. Just came to see you'd never do that to me, would you, baby? It's being around you is all I see.
Al Green of Lee County with Let's Stay Together, released May 1971, his first number one hit. It's another song of Arkansas. From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkansongs.
Arkansongs is a production of Experiment Station Studios. Executive producer is Keith Merks. Arkansongs is underwritten by the Old State House Museum in Little Rock, a museum of the Department of Arkansas Heritage. Arkansongs, since 1998.
Support for 91.3 comes from Arcega's Coffee Roasters and Arcega's at the Depot, presenting Wine Wednesday. Each Wednesday offers various wines, weekly dinner pairings, and live local musicians. Located in downtown Fayetteville, Arcega's at the Depot on Facebook for more information. The 17th Annual Art of Wine Festival presents Uncorked Wine Tasting, June 9th at 7 p.m. This summer social party offers over 500 wines, plus cheeses, beers, desserts, and bubbles. A limited number of tickets available at waltonartcenter.org or 443-5600. The spring sports schedule is heavy, with teams moving from one level of a season to another. The Arkansas softball team will be back in the NCAA tournament after a three-year hiatus. The Razorbacks learned yesterday they will be sent to Norman, Oklahoma, to play Tulsa Friday morning at 11:30 in the Norman Regional. That game will be shown on the SEC Network. Arkansas enters the tournament with a 31-22 record. All 13 softball teams in the SEC earned a spot in that tournament. The University of Arkansas Fort Smith baseball team will make its debut in the NCAA Division II tournament Thursday. The Lions will face Angelo State in the South Central Regional in San Angelo, Texas. UAFS is 33-18, and they've won 28 of their last 38. First pitch Thursday is scheduled for 11 a.m. The Arkansas men's golf team is opening play in the NCAAs today at the Baton Rouge Regional. Arkansas is ranked 31st in the country. The Razorback women's tennis season is over after the Razorbacks fell to Oklahoma State in the NCAAs yesterday in Stillwater, Oklahoma. That loss came after Arkansas defeated Wichita State in the NCAA first round on Saturday. And the baseball Razorbacks are improving their chance to host an NCAA regional. Yesterday, Arkansas defeated Vanderbilt 7-1 to take 2 of 3 from the Commodores this weekend in Fayetteville. Arkansas's regular season concludes with 3 games at Texas A&M beginning Thursday night. And this is 91.3 KUAF, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, and Sonora. Ozarks at Large, a production of KUAF. I'm Kyle Kellums. Thanks for listening.